Coming up, Lav and I recap a historic week for the U.S. team at the Ryder Cup. Welcome to the Golf Central podcast presented by Callaway Golf. Xander Schauffele put on an unforgettable performance at the Ryder Cup with a new driver in the bag. He switched into a lower spinning Epic driver head at Whistling Straits, where he earned 3 points for the victorious U.S. side. Schauffele's new gamer promotes the tight draw that he's looking for off the tee, and it works well in combination with his Chrome Soft XLS golf ball. John Rahm had a standout week with his Epic driver 2 as he clinched 3.5 points for the European team. For more information on their drivers, visit CallawayGolf.com. Lav, I'm going to just go ahead and go into it. Lean into my failures, as they say, as you should always do. I think I predicted the European team comfortably 3 points is what I said. I will own it. Have never been more wrong in my entire life.
I mean, that's really saying something, because you've been doing this for, let's call it 25 years or so. And what was most odd when we did the preview pod last week was your only rationale for picking Europe was the fact that they'd won 9 of 12 for the last 5, whatever stat you wanted to use. And that's just not a good enough reason. You were basically ignoring every recent trend that you were heading into these matches at Whistling Straits. The United States team was playing better. They had 8 of the top 10 players in the world. They were playing on home soil. They had a captain who had seemingly done all of the right moves heading in. They had some ready-made pairings. While Europe had a lot of moving pieces along with some other aging warriors. It didn't make any sense then. It certainly doesn't make any sense now in hindsight, with the U.S. coming off their 19-9 victory. I said that the U.S. would win comfortably. I did not think that would be 10 points. I thought that would be somewhere in the 4 to 5 point range, something that we'd seen over the past couple of Ryder Cups. It certainly seemed like we're having a divide now where the home team dominates, the home team dominates, the home team dominates, the home team dominates. And that very well may be the case again in Rome in 2 years' time. But this certainly felt like more than just a lopsided American victory. I'm not sure about you, Rex, but it certainly felt like this was a significant moment and perhaps a turning of the tide and a kind of a generational shift for this cup.
I think so. And it certainly had all the makings of that. The young U.S. team, as you pointed out, I did not ignore any of those things you said. I acknowledged all of those things. Go back and read my preview piece. I pointed out that the Americans, by any measure...
Your preview piece, not your preview pod.
Well, again, I think I said the same things. You're just kind of glossing over and ignoring where I got to the punchline, where I got to the soundbite, where I said the thing that you want to come back and bite me. And it has come back and bitten me. I did not ignore any of those things. And this felt like, I think you and I had a very long conversation, a sea change. That, look, you have the aging Europeans, you have the young Americans. It felt like this was a changing of the guard, a new generation for the U.S. Maybe the Europeans are going to flounder a little bit because I don't see a lot in that pipeline. The only reason I made this argument, and you're right, it's clearly paper thin at this point, was it was the eye test. I had to see it. We hadn't seen it in the last, I don't know, 2 decades. There had been occasional flashes of brilliance for the U.S. team, but by and large,
they throttled the Europeans at Hazeltine.
And the Europeans throttled the U.S. team in Paris.
And barring a fluke, they would have throttled them again at Medina.
But there was a fluke. So that's where you're forgetting. There was the miracle at Medina and everything that went into that. So if you look at the domination that the Europeans had, I needed to see it. You needed to have the eye test. I don't know. We can sit here and talk about the University of Georgia before they play their first game and how great they should be. Until you see it, you don't actually know. Now that I've seen it, yeah, this is domination. I mean, that was a level of, I don't want to say it was mean-spirited, but there was a little bit of malice on Sunday. It's one thing to get the win and to enjoy yourself. It's another thing to go out and want to set the record. Obviously want to get those 19 points just to prove the point that we're that much better than you are.
Yeah, I mean, it ended up being 19-9. And for about an hour or two, Rex, on Ryder Cup Sunday, it looked like the U.S. might hang 21 points on them, which is a total that was just unfathomable before a couple of late turnarounds for some of the European matches. And I think you bring up a good point that there was a little bit of malice, a little bit of anger, a little bit of wanting to make a statement. Patrick Cantlay was among those. Tony Finau saying that he wanted to run up the score. And that's why I think this did mark a sea change or kind of a generational shift for the United States. I'm not saying that in past years that that hasn't been the case where they didn't want to run up the score and have a dominant victory. I'm not saying that at all. But I think when you look at this roster of players, there is something different about this group. They're all Tiger babies, or for the most part. I mean, these are guys who grew up living, breathing, just admiring everything that Tiger Woods did. And Tiger Woods had that MJ-like mentality of step on their throats. I mean, that was what you wrote on Sunday night at the Ryder Cup, that was Tiger's message to the group, step on their throats. And so that sense of
next
of, step of on their vengeance necks. Is imbued in this young American roster. And to me, the guy who really embodies that is Justin Thomas. He didn't have his greatest week. He went 2-1-1, but I think back to a quote he said a couple years ago when he was, I think he was when he was paired with Tiger Woods. And someone asked him, you know, how much, you know, why do you think you have so much success, you know, head to head when paired with Tiger? And he said, I want to make the person that I'm playing with quit golf. And like it kind of took you for a loop. Like, wow. I mean, that's pretty intense. And a lot of these guys have that sort of intensity. Colin Morikawa does it quietly, but he is supremely confident. Tony Finau has been an athlete his entire life. He has that sense. Patrick Cantlay is just a cold-blooded killer. I mean, Xander Schauffele, the very same way, just a quiet assassin. Jordan Spieth, yeah, he's a little bit kinder and gentler, but they all have this sort of killer instinct. And when you have a group with an average age of 29, it's feasible that they could be doing this for the next 3 to 4 cups, which is why we think this is potentially a generational shift. It's just the mindset of this younger, hungrier group for sure.
And Patrick Cantlay, nicest guy in the world. You expect to see him somewhere in a library at a college studying. I mean, thoughtful, insightful, a lot of retrospect there. He wanted to step on their necks, which is what Tiger wanted to do. He was leading the charge. You get an idea. I do want to, before we go too far down the rabbit hole, I did want to point out that one thing, and this is a generational thing as well. Dustin Johnson was clearly the holdover from those previous generations. He was really the only thing that connected the team to any of these previous losses, and you didn't know how he was going to act. And I wrote yesterday, Monday, on the way home, that not only was he the man of the match for the U.S. team going 5-0-0, as the oldest player on the team, he was the only one that went 5 matches. That was not the plan, by the way. It was one of the rare instances that we uncovered that Steve Stricker deviated from what he wanted to do. But beyond that, Dustin Johnson won the press conference. And that's a sentence I never in my entire life thought I was going to utter.
DJ wins every one of these team press conferences after win or lose.
After a win, not a loss. Not a loss. After a win, there's nothing better than DJ after a win.
I mean, he says more in these winners' press conferences than he does in press conferences the entire year combined. I mean, you can't shut the guy up. You're asking a question to Justin Thomas and DJ pipes in. You ask a question to Spieth and DJ pipes in. You ask a question to Bryson and DJ pipes in. I mean, he had something to say about everything. Where is this guy the other 20 tournaments that we're interviewing him when he's as boring as you can possibly imagine of a PGA Tour player being?
I mean, historically, and again, to pull back the curtain a little bit here, the PGA Tour and most golf organizations, they will hold Dustin Johnson, and this is even when he was world number one, they will hold his press conferences as late as humanly possible on Wednesday afternoon, 5:30,
like
6 o'clock.
4:30, 5 o'clock.
Yeah. And this is on purpose. This is by design because they know that no one's going to go in there, that no one's going to have anything
interesting
to ask.
And DJ doesn't want to do it.
And he doesn't want to do it. It's a very, very actually insightful move by either the PGA Tour or DJ's handlers or whoever, knowing that, look, we're not going to continue to put our guy in a situation where he's not going to say anything and, you know, dance around all these questions. You put him in this context, and let's be honest, there was a lot of, I'm going to guess, vodka tonic involved. I mean, maybe tequila. I don't know what he had, the clear liquid he had in the cup, but there was a lot of that. Yeah, there was a little bit of, there was some champagne involved from some pictures I saw. But not just entertaining because he had over imbibed. That's not the thing. I think you get to see a glimpse of the real Dustin Johnson that we don't see on a day in and day out basis on the PGA Tour. He does have a sense of humor. He is a team player. I again, if you look at what Steve Stricker wanted to do with this team and the way it played out, almost to a T, that blueprint worked. Davis Love told me the only thing that really deviated was they had no intentions of playing anybody all four team sessions, but Dustin had been playing so well with Colin Morikawa, with Xander Schauffele, that they couldn't sit him on Saturday afternoon. They had to send him back out because they you didn't want to sit him and have the Europeans win that afternoon session on Saturday like they did at Medina and get some sort of momentum going into Sunday. So I will give, again, a monsoon of credit to Steve Stricker. He stuck to the plan until he didn't have to. And that's a great example of a good captain.
Yeah, absolutely. And you do make a good point also about DJ. I mean, he is one of the more popular players in the PGA Tour locker room. I mean, you'd be hard pressed to find a single player on the PGA Tour who does not like Dustin Johnson. And so the DJ that we see in press conference is certainly not, I would say, representative of the DJ that all of these guys in the PGA Tour know and love. And I think that's important to point out. You do mention Steve Stricker, and he was who I wrote on Sunday night. And this was just about a flawless captaincy from start to finish. And there's a lot of things that have gone into this. He had an extra year to prepare. I certainly think the extra year benefited the U.S. team more, certainly than the European squad. I mean, it seems like the Europeans just got a year older. They didn't necessarily get a year better. When you look at the Americans team, this allowed Jordan Spieth to find his way into form. This allowed Patrick Cantlay to take his game to the next level. This allowed Xander Schauffele to get over the hump at the Olympics and win a tournament. I mean, everything kind of coalesced for this group to really hit its stride and have a dominant victory here. So that was just one of the pieces, but there was so many little things as well. I think it was important for Steve Stricker, knowing how the worldwide schedule was in flux because of COVID, to ask for more captain's picks, not fewer, which is what Padraig Harrington did. That allowed him to kind of shape the roster that he wanted. I think it was important to move on from the era of Patrick Reed and kind of leaving that toxic presence out of there and really valuing camaraderie and cohesiveness in the team room. I think it was important to move on from Phil Mickelson as well, and not just moving on from Phil, but also reincorporating him in a new role as an assistant captain, kind of grooming him and getting him as part of this group that we're going to see now, particularly if Phil is going to get the nod in 2025 at Bethpage against Ian Poulter, like we're all anticipating. And then when you actually get to the week of the Ryder Cup, Steve Stricker pulled all the right strings. These guys do not need rah-rah speeches. They do not need motivational videos. He said they don't need some famous celebrity to come in and tell them how important the Ryder Cup week is. They know it. This is a group of talented, hungry Americans who are sick of being embarrassed in this competition. Steve Stricker took a step back, allowed them to really flourish and unlock and just kind of explode with all of their talent, their animosity, the vengeance that they wanted to take off on the Europeans. Steve Stricker was the perfect hands-off captain. I wrote he was the perfect captain for these modern times. This is what the Americans need. They don't need kind of the hard edges of a Tom Watson or even kind of the rah-rah nature of like a Davis Love or a Paul Azinger. I mean, hands-off, let these guys do what they do, and this is kind of the result you're going to have.
Someone in the media center, I can't remember who said it, but it was brilliant because they suggested, why don't the American team just do what, say, USA basketball does? Coach K was the coach of the USA basketball team, if I know this correctly, for over a decade. Every year, whatever international event was going on, whether it's the Olympics or whatever the case may be, he was going to be the coach because he was so good for all the reasons that you just pointed out. Very hands-off, knew the game, knew what his players needed, knew what each team needed. And someone suggested, why don't we just do that with Stricker? And Freddie Couples, I mean, you can throw Freddie in there as well. Clearly, he's cut from the same mold. The guys love him to be around. It doesn't matter how old he is. And he brings with him Michael Jordan, which only makes things better. Well, why don't we just stop with the pretense of every 2 years we need to, you know, let someone learn how to do this. Let someone learn how to coach this particular team. Instead of doing that, here you go, Steve. And he doesn't want it. It was obvious.
He doesn't want it. No. And that's the whole point of having the task force, isn't it? Is that you have guys incorporated like a Zach Johnson, and you're going to have obviously Tiger get his turn for a Ryder Cup, and now Phil getting his turn for a Ryder Cup. They can see what works and what doesn't. I would expect if Zach Johnson gets a nod in 2023, which certainly seems like the expectation, I think he should, I'm not sure if he will, he should take a lot of cues from what Steve Stricker did this week.
Well, and to your point, the task force or the committee, whatever it's called now, and I gave them, again, a monsoon of credit for this, and it's been maligned and people have made fun of it over the years. Fact of the matter is, without the task force, Steve Stricker would have never probably gotten his turn as a Ryder Cup captain, because he wasn't part of that major championship club before Glenn Eagles and what happened there and the American team falling apart and Phil Mickelson calling out Tom Watson and everything else that went into that. It was going to be a major champion that was going to be picked as a Ryder Cup captain, which would have left Steve Stricker and a lot of very, very good captains in the future, in my opinion, off the slate. So you have to give the task force credit on that. I wanted to revisit something you said, and I did these numbers Sunday afternoon just out of curiosity. And this is all kind of, you know, hindsight and 2020 stuff. But I went and looked what the team would have looked like had we played on time and have not been for the pandemic. It would have been basically the same players who would have qualified. Bryson would have qualified. Webb Simpson would have qualified, which is interesting there. And I'm not saying that Webb wouldn't have fit into this team or he would have fit into this team. It's just it would have been a different dynamic. But there would have been only four picks. And first out of the gates in those four picks would have been Daniel Berger, who turned out to be a good pick, a good fit. Tony Finau, as you pointed out, another good. Gary Woodland, not quite sure you could have gone wrong there. And then Kevin Kisner would have been right there on the bubble. But right behind Kevin Kisner would have been Tiger Woods. And then outside of those would have been Patrick Cantlay and Harris Inglis, Scottie Scheffler at 20th, Jordan Spieth at 25th. There's no way Stricker would have gotten to either one of those players. Probably wouldn't have gotten to Patrick Cantlay at 15, and it's hard to imagine Tiger Woods at 13th, him passing over. So just imagine how different this team would have looked had we played just a year earlier.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, it is crazy to think about. And I think moving forward, when you look at this European side, they're aging out. I mean, there's no kind way to say it. They had the most 40-something players.
A lot of gray hair on that stage. A lot of gray hair on that stage.
It really is. I mean, they had more 40-somethings on that squad than any team in Ryder Cup history. We're talking about Ian Poulter. We're talking about Sergio Garcia. We're talking about Paul Casey, Lee Westwood, who seems like he's going to get the nod in 2023 if all signs kind of play out the way that we're anticipating. Those guys did not have a good week. I know Westwood and Poulter won their singles match with late turnaround, and it was great to see. Because that's very likely their final cup appearance. But Paul Casey went 0-4 when he played Dustin Johnson in all four of those matches, but he's 44 years old. Sergio Garcia had a very good Ryder Cup. It seems like he's not going anywhere anytime soon. But Ian Poulter, I mean, he's been terrible in partner play since Medina. It's hard to imagine that he's ever going to get another opportunity. Westwood went 1-2. When you start to look at what this European team is going to look like in 2 years' time. Yeah, of course, you're going to have John Rahm and Roy McIlroy and Victor Hovland. You expect those guys to be cornerstones for at least the next couple of cups until Roy McIlroy starts to approach age 40 as well. Who else? I mean, who else is going to fill out the middle of this European roster? They've had a lot of turnover with kind of these one-hit wonders when you think of guys like Nicholas Kolsarts or a Victor Dubuisson or Thomas Peters. I mean, these are guys who kind of flashed in one cup and then fell away. Where are all the mainstays? Is it going to be someone like Matt Fitzpatrick, who became the first player in more than 40 years to not earn a single point in his two Ryder Cup appearances? I mean, Tommy Fleetwood clearly wasn't as good in partner play this time without Francesco Molinari. Tyrrell Hatton, this is another big stage that he hasn't showed up. And Shane Lowry, I thought, was kind of the heart and soul of this team. But it remains to be seen if he can continue this kind of form in 2 years' time. Where do you see this European side going? Because obviously the U.S. side, and you just mentioned the guys who could have been on this team had it been played a year earlier, the U.S. just continues to kind of rebuild and restock. I'm not sure where the European side is going because they have about three or four great players at the top, and then a whole lot of question marks after that.
I think that's correct. However, I think you can go back historically and look at the formula. They have normally only had three or four or five good players, and everyone else they kind of have to hide and figure out how to work around. But I mean, if you look at historically when they turn this thing around, essentially added the rest of Europe, it's always been a matter. You know, in our ADD world where we're trying to write Sunday and you're scrambling down notes, that I just glanced over as you were kind of going through all of those gray war horses, the old Europeans. And the line I wrote down was DJ ended Paul Casey. And I'm a big Paul Casey fan, but Paul Casey went up against DJ four times this week and just got his brains beat in every single time. Like, I don't know that he wants to play another Ryder Cup if that's going to be what he has to endure every single week.
I mean, DJ played great and Paul Casey just didn't have it, which to me was actually a surprise. I mean, I think when you look statistically at Paul Casey's year, this was one of the best seasons that he's had. I mean, he's a very complete player and he just didn't have the goods. Will he have it in 2 years time when he's 46 years old? I think that's TBD. I think there's, you know, potentially a need, maybe even a want to turn the page on some of these old war horses and kind of infuse this European team with a little bit more vigor, a little bit more youth. When you think of the Hogard twins, or you think of Sam Horsfield or Thomas Dietrich. I mean, there are guys in the pipeline. I'm not sure they're going to be ready in 2 years' time, but we always knew there was always going to be the situation where one European captain went back to the well one too many times, right? Where you relied on some of these old war horses one too many time. Unfortunately, Padraig Harrington happened to be that guy, and he was, you know, he was on the other side of what is now a historic defeat.
And I don't know that he had many options. I mean, we can go back and second guess, and I'm sure that's what the European press.
He certainly made some mistakes. There's no doubt about it. But his hands were also tied.
But it just wasn't a good team. And this isn't to take away from any of their individual accomplishments. As a team, this was probably, I mean, you can go back and pick apart. 2008 was clearly a bad team as well for the Europeans. I don't know if it was historically bad, but if you start stacking it up statistically, it's probably pretty close, at least in the modern era. The one element, and you're right, I don't see a farm system for the continent right now. That's not to say that in 2 years' time that there won't be two or three new stars, because, again, Victor Hovland has a lot of potential. I don't know that Rory has another Ryder Cup that's quite this bad. I mean, the emotions that he showed on Sunday clearly told a story about what this means to him and how disappointed he was to come out and fall flat. Sergio Garcia and John Rahm, I think they at least have one or two more cups. And certainly John Rahm does, but I'm thinking as a pair, he and Sergio, maybe not the new Armada, but it's certainly very, very close. The interesting part for me, and you kind of glossed over this, is when we start thinking about captains for the U.S. side, and clearly Zach Johnson seemed to be in the hopper for Rome in 2 years. On the other side, it would be Lee Westwood. I mean, they're pretty transparent about sort of their line of succession and who they want next and how they groom those people. There is a fly in the ointment when it comes to how this could play out, because Lee Westwood has made it perfectly clear that whatever the Super Golf League is, or the iteration that is going to be going forward, he is 100% in. Like, he made it clear at the PGA Championship that, yes, if they want to pay me money, that much money at this stage of my career, I'm all in for this. And you can't blame him. However, it seems like this is going to come to a tipping point, because the PGA Tour, the PGA of America, the European Tour, they've made it clear that they're not going to allow this. And so the end result here would be, if it comes to the nuclear scenario, is that Lee doesn't get his turn as captain. I think that would be crushing for the European side. So it's going to be a subtext. It's going to be, you know, kind of a side story. But I just don't know how in January, which is kind of the normal MO for when we start naming captains again going forward, if they're going to be willing to, yes, point to Lee and it's yours right out of the gates, because I think there's still too many unknowns.
I mean, if it's not Lee, it's probably going to be Henrik Stenson. I mean, there's certainly a bunch of guys who can get the nod on the European side. I do agree that Westy kind of has this hold over this group. I mean, he's a legendary figure, 11 Ryder Cup appearances now. He's close with all these guys on the European side. Yeah. They would love to have Westwood as a captain. And when you think of the history that the Americans have not won on foreign soil since 1993, they're once again, in all likelihood, going to have the stronger team in Rome. But when you think of the setup changes that the European side can make, wanting to win one for Westy, potentially restocking with some younger talent, I still think they're going to be a force in 2 years' time, regardless of who's captain.
I think so. And you brought this up earlier. I kind of wanted to circle back around, and you brought up the obvious, that it seems to me that we're in a home and home deal, that the home team seems to not only win, but they're doing it in dominant fashion now. And there's something to be said for the dynamics of those particular teams. In this case, though, and this has come up in recent years, that, look, golf course setup is always going to favor the home team or equally try to punish the visiting team, Paris, being the ultimate example of that. The Americans had no chance on that golf course. Especially, I mean, when you think of what Bryson DeChambeau did last week at Whistling Straits, 417 yards on number five. I mean, it was just this otherworldly performance by him off the tee. That never works in Paris because he's off the planet. He's in downtown Paris. He never had a chance. We can only assume they're going to do the same thing in Rome. And it leads to the conversation that has the golf course setup become too much?
I mean, this is now four consecutive Ryder Cups of at least a 5-point margin of victory. I mean, blowouts are not good for the Ryder Cup. They're not entertaining to watch. Yeah, all these guys love to play in this tournament, but they want to be involved in a close match too. I mean, I think we're dangerously close from having it too far on the opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah. No, I agree. And this has gotten brought up, and I don't know how comfortable the PGA of America or the European Tour would be with it, but have a neutral body set the golf course up. The one that came up was the USGA, and I was kind of like, is that who we really want to set up the golf course?
Nope.
Based on their history, I don't know if that's who you do it. The PGA Tour would be a little, you would just assume they would come
in. You can't have that PGA Tour. You got to have you basically have to have the USGA and RNA work in collaboration.
RNA that I was coming around to. I would just let the RNA look. It seems to me like very, very rarely do we ever complain about golf course setup at an Open Championship. It just doesn't happen. And if it happens, it's because of some crazy weather conditions. Let the RNA do it. Let them do it every single time in the US and in Europe. I feel like they could be impartial because, again, you're getting to a point where this feels like I see your sausage finger. I'll let you in here in a second. Just give me 1 minute. I think we're getting to a point where the home field advantage is just too much of an advantage. You're taking away from what should be a much better competition.
All right, Rex, let's move on to some superlatives for this 43rd Ryder Cup. The easy one is the man of the match. It was historic on the U.S. side with Dustin Johnson becoming just the second player since 1979, the second American, to post a perfect 5-0 record, partnered beautifully with Colin Morikawa, which was really a surprise. I don't think any of us necessarily pegged those two together. We certainly didn't anticipate Dustin Johnson at 37 being the gray beard of the group to go all five matches. Dustin Johnson did not have his best season on the PGA Tour. In fact, it was one of his worst statistically on the PGA Tour. But I thought he finally found that partner that had been missing in Colin Morikawa. They certainly played off each other well. Dustin Johnson, man of the match on the American side. For the Europeans, that was also pretty obvious to me as well who the MVP would be. That would be John Rahm, even though he ran into a buzzsaw in Scottie Scheffler, losing the first five holes in Sunday singles. I thought he was absolutely fantastic, and he left little doubt that John Rahm is the undisputed number one player in the world, and he was the best player at Whistling Straits.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to argue. It's impossible to argue with either one of those. And again, when I kind of wrote, and it was surprising that DJ, not that he had a good week, I guess you could predict. I mean, he's a good player, multiple major wins. He's headed to the Hall of Fame, all the things that you could say. What stood out is that he became a leader. And no, I mean, he joked in the press conference, imbibed whatever, you know, on Rocket Fuel, whatever he may have been on at the time, about how he was the emotional, the lightning rod leader. Of course he wasn't. That's not his style. Talking with Davis Love, who was kind of in charge of DJ's pod, talking with Claude Harmon, his swing coach. Every Ryder Cup, there's someone who steps up, leads by example. And if you kind of look at DJ's history, he's never done it because he's never had to do it. If you kind of think it's always been Tiger Woods, it's always been Phil Mickelson, it's always been their teams, and you always kind of follow their lead. DJ knew instinctively this time around that I need to not just be a leader, and that's not standing in front of guys and pounding your chest. That's proving a point. I was told by multiple sources that when the U.S. team went up to Whistling Straits for the scouting trip the week before the matches, no one worked harder or played more holes than DJ. And that when it came time to go five matches, it was never even a conversation. Of course it would be DJ. Again, oldest guy out there. He's in very, very good shape. We're not saying that, you know, we're sending the geriatric guy out there.
That's not Lee Westwood who's being sent out there for five matches.
Absolutely not. Still in prime shape. I mean, still an athlete, no doubt about it. However, it was all by example. You put him with a rookie in the hardest format, first thing out Friday morning. Again, this is what leaders do. Okay, yeah, I'd love to have Colin Morikawa. Again, you're not saddling with a bad player, but you're giving him a rookie in a situation that has not gone well for the US side, and you're hoping for the best, and DJ delivered. He's easily the man of the match for the US side. And yeah, John Rahm, I mean, I'm sure whatever happened on Sunday was difficult for him to swallow just because he's such a competitor with Scottie Scheffler throwing five birdies at him through his first six holes. But everything else was the one promising thing I think the Europeans can take forward between he and Sergio Garcia.
What was your biggest surprise? Obviously, you were surprised by the end result, considering once again that you picked Europe to win by three. But what was your biggest surprise, either positively or negatively? Could be a player, could be a development. What would you say?
I was a little surprised, Scottie Scheffler. And again, this has nothing to do with whether or not he's a world-class player. It just has to do with he was probably, you would make the argument that he was the only true rookie on the U.S. side because the other quote-unquote rookies had some experience, at least at the President's Cup. And he was just fearless. And it seems like he wanted to go out against John Rahm. Clearly, it's a blind draw, and you don't know the Sunday singles. But you probably had a pretty good idea that the Europeans had to front-load the lineup if they had any chance of coming back from that historic deficit. And Scotty seemed to want it. He seemed to cherish the idea. I mean, when he beat John Rahm at the match play earlier this year, it was eye-opening. It was cool. But you're comparing the match play to the Ryder Cup. Those are two different, wildly different animals. And for the way he performed, I was a little surprised and very impressed.
Remember when everyone wanted to pick like Kevin Kisner or Billy Horschel? Or
who's
Kevin
everyone? Ma? Who's that? Give me the everyone's. Don't do that.
I mean, there was a whole lot of social chatter to have any of those guys, especially once Billy Horschel won the BMW PGA. I mean, everyone's thinking, oh, this is exactly why you got to wait for the pick, or this is exactly why Billy Horschel is the guy who should be on this team, or Kevin Kisner, he's going to be great in the team room. He's such a great putter. Or Kevin Na, he's the guy who's playing the best coming in. There wasn't a whole lot of love for Scotty, and yet Steve Stricker really didn't waver on his pick. He knew Scottie Scheffler would be a good fit. He knew he would be kind of a gel piece in that team room. And Steve Stricker was proven correct. I was very impressed with Scottie Scheffler. Now I think he can finally turn his attention to winning on the PGA Tour, which does not seem like it's all that far away. For me, the biggest surprise was Victor Hovland. We knew that Europe was going to have to lean on their horses at Whistling Straits. They knew they were going to have to get five matches from John Rahm, from Rory McIlroy. That didn't turn out to be the case since he got benched. And Victor Hovland, we knew they were going to go five. And Hovland just flat out did not show up. I did not see him going 0-3-2 in his debut Ryder Cup. He really just could not find a solid partner. You think about what he did on Friday. He lost with Paul Casey to DJ and Morikawa. In the afternoon, he halved a match with Tommy Fleetwood, who was coming off a 5-0 performance, a 4-0 performance of his own in Paris. You think about on Saturday, he was saddled with a rookie in Bernd Wiesberger. That did not go well. In the afternoon, Fleetwood, that did not go well. And then on Sunday, in this singles match, which really was kind of a non-factor in the final result, obviously, he was able to eke out a half point against Morikawa. But I don't think it's any stretch to say that one of the biggest disappointments, if not the biggest disappointment, was the play of Victor Hovland. I expect him to be much stronger in 2 years' time in Rome.
Yeah, I'm not going to be as tough. He's a rookie. He was on foreign soil. He had a lot of things going against him. And I know you had high expectations. Obviously, the Europeans had high expectations. Mine's going to be Rory. And look, the emotions, the raw emotions, that's why we love Rory. But you got an idea of how bad the week actually was, that when he gets asked a very simple, mundane question about the week, and for him to break down emotionally gives you an idea of what this means to him and how disappointing. I mean, that one's going to stick with him for a while, and you would expect him to be around for quite a few teams.
Why do you think he was so emotional?
Well, twofold. I mean, I think he knew what he needed to do, what the team expected of him. What if they had any chance of winning, I think he knew the things that you just said, that they needed to count on the horses. And John Rahm and Sergio Garcia delivered. again, I'm not going to be quite as hard on Victor Hovland as you are. Rory definitely needed to deliver. And I mean, he completely, and part of this, like sending him out with Ian Poulter, do we really think that was going to work out? I mean, Ian Poulter has been playing terrible golf the last few months. I don't know why, to your point, I thought that was an insane stat. When you look at his record since Medina, he's not a good Ryder Cup player.
He's 1-6 and 2 in team play. 1-6 and 2. This was Ian Poulter's last Ryder Cup, or at least it better be, if Europe wants to win.
I mean, he'll come back as a vice captain and a captain someday. But yeah, I think Rory is the one that I had the hardest time wrapping my mind around, because he was playing well coming into this. It's not like he was struggling. If you look at his record through the playoffs, I mean, he put himself into contention. We talked about this, I think, one day at lunch. He is by far the most inconsistent star player in the game right now. You just don't know what you're going to get from him.
Yeah, it is a little bit of a mix and match when it comes to Rory's form of late. You know, the swing changes with Pete Cowan are obviously still a work in progress. And I'm with you about his emotion on Sunday. I think it was twofold. I think the fact of the matter is he had high expectations for himself and he felt like he let the team down. I think secondly, the emotion is it's looking at the significance of this event now for Rory. I mean, five Ryder Cups ago, he said that this is just an exhibition and he didn't really care about it and it should just be kind of fun. He's clearly gone to the other side of the spectrum on this. And I think the reason why he was so emotional in part was because he knew that this was the end for a lot of these European stalwarts, whether it was Ian Poulter, Lee Westwood, Sergio Garcia, looks like he has a lot more, but Paul Casey, this could have been his last one as well. I think he wanted to send them out on a high note. And I think it's just, he wants to push pause on this period of time. It kind of feels like he's slipping away. You build up to these moments. They're so special to be a part of if you're in that team room, and then it's gone. And what is now is never going to happen again. And I think that's kind of a sobering realization for Rory, who is one of the most quality humans that you're going to find in the world of golf. And I think that was certainly playing a significant role in why he was so emotional. Let's play a fun game, Rex, of who on this U.S. team will not be a part of this team in 2023. There's a whole lot that can happen in two years' time. Just think about Jordan Spieth. He was left off that U.S. President's Cup team by Captain Tiger Woods a little less than 2 years ago, and now he's one of the best players in the world, a factor at many majors this year, had another solid week for this U.S. team. When you look at this roster and you think about all of the hard-charging players behind this group, who was left off, who was on that B squad, whether it was Sam Burns or Billy Horschel or Will Zalatoris. I mean, in all likelihood, you're not going to have all 12 of these guys make that team in 2023. Who's your pick for who will not be there?
Oh, God, this one's tough. I mean, Steve Stricker is the obvious choice. I don't think he wants anything to do.
He's not a part of the team. He's not getting a shot.
I know. I was going for the cheap out. I guess if I had to pick one right now that I'm just not 100% sold on, and look, he has had a fantastic season, so I don't even know why I'm saying this. I need to see more out of Daniel Berger on a consistent basis. I mean, he has come through, and he just struggled. He seems to have his fluctuations, his struggles seem to be more dramatic than the other players of this ilk, those 2011, you know, high school class graduations. Granted, Jordan Spieth hit rock bottom, but he came back. Justin Thomas has had his issues. Daniels seem to go wildly up and down. So I'd like to see a little bit more consistency. If I had to pick one out of the 12, and this is tough, it would be him.
Yeah, that's a very good pick. I mean, winning, he won at Pebble Beach earlier this year. He had a couple of other solid finishes. I mean, he's a very complete player on the PGA Tour. He's top 25.
Let's do this game for the European team. It's so much easier for the European team. I mean, you could sit here and go basically 8 out of the 12.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Boog, you could see him getting left off. I love Harris English. I've made no bones about that. He's 32 years old. He's clearly enjoyed a career renaissance at this point. Can he sustain this type of career form for two more years? I think that's to be seen. I do think it is going to be interesting, Rex, when you think of 12 months time and you get that U.S. President's Cup team. I mean, the U.S. has just had their way with the international squad over the history of this event. Will that be an opportunity for the captain to kind of pick some of these younger guys, you know, kind of bring in a Will Zalatoris or Sam Burns, get them some experience for if they're called upon a year later in Rome, they're not going to be overwhelmed by the moment and be a quote unquote true rookie in what would be a very daunting road game. We're going to have some turnover. A lot can happen. We just don't know who it's going to be.
Does that sound like Davis Love? I mean, again, I'm a big fan of Davis Love, but that sounds like, yeah, he's going to reinvent the President's Cup and try to give these young guys. Does that sound like something he's going to do? I'm just asking.
No, but I also didn't think Steve Stricker was going to leave off a guy like Webb Simpson when he had the opportunity to kind of have Webb on that as one of those captain's picks.
Rex, well, to your point, I would argue that, again, we all sort of dismissed the idea that there were six rookies on that team. And I think there's something to be said for whatever it is, Xander and Patrick and the rest of them learn down in Australia playing for Captain Tiger Woods. It carried over. Like, there was something to be seen. It was interesting. Like, we kind of knew Xander Schauffele and Patrick Cantlay were going to turn out to be a good pairing for the U.S. going forward. When I kind of dug in and found out how this all came about, like, Tiger really did not have that pairing on his radar. That sort of came organically from the idea that these two Southern California guys, friends, Freddie Couples, had to get in Tiger's ear and tell him, like, hey, bud, you may want to look at these two foursomes. I know it's a tough format for the Americans, but let's give it a shot. So to your point, it's a good lab. It's a good chance for the U.S. side to start mixing and matching. And I hope that Davis Love does exactly that next year.
Yes or no, and we'll get off on this point. Yes or no, the U.S. wins in 2023.
Oh, man. Again, the golf course setup has become such a big part of the equation, and I don't see that changing when we go to Rome, so it's hard for me to say yes. I guess I need to see it. Our colleague Jaime Diaz said it really well on Sunday night from the live from. I thought that, look, this is great, and we can all sit here and say this is a generational change and everything that these young players are bringing to it. But again, the eye test, I kind of do want to see it on foreign soil. We haven't done this in a very, very long time. Didn't I? Oh, man.
Again, unbelievable. It would have been 30 years. Oh, it would have been 30 years away.
So I kind of need to see it, but I don't want to take anything away from this win. I mean, I think it was commanding. It was historic, all the things that we want to throw at it, but it's hard to win on foreign soil. So I'm going to go, no, we don't win. Again, I need to see
it. You just said we again.
I might as well lean into it.
What is wrong
with
you?
It's going to cost me a fortune. I might as well just lean into it.
I'm going to go out on a very small limb and say that the U.S. does win in 2023. If they're ever going to do it,
I'm the one on the limb on that one, not you. How are you on the limb on that one?
Because it hasn't happened, and so as you say, you
want the eye test as well.
That was the same rationale you just used when you picked Europe by 3 and then they lost by 10. But I'm gonna say the U.S. will win. Their core is an average of 29. That's worth repeating. They're gonna be 30. The average age of 31 if the nucleus of this team returns in 2 years' time, which I do think that you could expect that. Europe is going to be down. That's a golf course that no one really is all that familiar with in Marco Simone. They just had a European Tour event there a couple of months ago. The reviews of that golf course were very mixed. It's not like they have some kind of institutional knowledge about how to play that place. So everyone's going to be kind of getting their first looks at it. I do not think that is a scenario that is ripe for Europe to continue its dominance on home soil. The Americans break the curse, 30-year drought. They will win in 2023. Rex, always enjoy the recap pods from a major event. Probably the last time you and I are going to be on the road for quite a while. Look forward to you coming to visit and changing some diapers, which are plentiful at this point. But thank you guys for listening to this edition of the Golf Central Podcast presented by Callaway Golf. We'll be back next week for a recap of all the week's action.